Oh, Joe is nice enough. He just never really saw Danielle. Kelly frowned. What's that mean? I guess it just means Joe was never right for Danielle, that's all. She seems pretty close with Chris. Are they together? I asked my brother, and he told me to ask Danielle. Sounds like your brother. Are they together? I get the idea they're dancing around the possibility. Now he's a hottie. Yeah, I suppose. Kelly sipped her water. You suppose? Lord, I'm always saying that boy could be an underwear model. Kelly frowned. Is he cuter than my brother? Lily smiled. Not to me. The server brought their burgers, and when she left the table, Lily asked, So, what's your deal? You interested in Sergeant Morelli? Well, I was, until he hauled me down to the police station a second time. Technically speaking, it was the chief who had you come in for questioning. But still, it was Joe who interviewed me, and I hated when he called me Ms. Bartley. Lily grinned. That is your name. It's just so hard to find a good guy. Kelly sighed. The cafe door opened, and in walked Heather Donovan. Lily noticed her immediately, while Kelly continued to stare dreamily into space, her thoughts occupied elsewhere. Heather looks like she slept in her clothes, Lily murmured under her breath. I saw your car out front, Heather said when she reached them. Without being asked, she sat down in one of the empty chairs at their table. So, what did you do for Valentine's Day? Lily asked. Danielle mentioned you didn't stay at Marlowe House last night. It'll be nice to move back to my own house, where people aren't keeping tabs on every move I make. Heather snapped, grabbing a menu from the middle of the table. Hey, I'm sorry. I didn't mean anything by it, Lily countered. Just wondered if you did something fun. Do I look like I've been having fun? Heather asked. Wow, don't bite my head off. Heather let out a sigh. I'm sorry, Lily. I've just had a really crappy week. This has been pretty crappy all around, Lily agreed. You want to talk about it? You know that guy who was in the paper this morning? The one they call a person of interest in Peter Morris's death? Lily and Kelly exchanged glances before Lily said, Yeah, the private investigator. He was my freaking private investigator, Heather seethed. You hired Mitch? Kelly asked. Heather frowned at Kelly. Mitch? You know him? Well, I know him as Mitch. He lives in the condo below mine. Really? Heather narrowed her eyes. Do the police know? Sure they know, Lily answered for Kelly. If they're looking for him, don't you think they know where he lives? Heather stared at Kelly. Doesn't mean the police know you live in the same building as him. They know, Kelly said quietly. That's why I'm staying at my brother's. I don't want to go home until they find him. So you know him? Before Kelly could answer, Heather said, I guess that's a silly question since you called him Mitch. So are you two friends or something? Why are you afraid to go back to your place? Is he dangerous? The paper didn't say anything about him being dangerous. No, I don't know him very well. I didn't even know he's a private detective or that his last name is Mitchum. Why did you hire him? Lily asked. To look into that issue with Presley House and Peter Morris. What did Peter Morris have to do with Presley House? Lily asked. I guess I never told you. Earthbound Spirits is the new owner of the property. They're the ones who got their hands on it after my mother failed to pay the property tax. No kidding. Why didn't you ever say anything to Ian about it? You know he's researching Earthbound Spirits for illegal activities, Lily asked. It wouldn't have helped Ian's story anyway. As it turned out, everything was handled legally. Not really what I wanted to hear, but what can I do about it now? Even if everything was handled legally, I can see where you'd still be pissed. Pretty easy to hold a grudge against someone who just walked in and took advantage of the situation when you were obviously vulnerable, Kelly noted. What is that supposed to mean? Heather snapped. Kelly shrugged. Nothing. I mean, well, that's just what Peter Morris did best. Take advantage of vulnerable people for his own profit. Well, I suppose the joke's on him, Heather chuckled. Why? Because he's dead? Lily asked. No, although that way too, Heather laughed. What I meant was, I guess the joke is on earthbound spirits. You see, according to the insurance company, I was no longer the owner of the Presley property when it burned down. Something neither of us were aware of at the time. So they aren't obligated to pay the claim. And while earthbound spirits got a great deal for a house on the property, the bare land is worth less than what they paid for it. Not to mention, the site still needs to be cleaned after the fire. From what I understand, the current property owner is obligated to do that. And since they never purchased homeowners insurance for it, they're basically screwed. 35. Perched atop a stack of boulders along the Oregon shoreline, Mitch glanced up at the gray clouds. They blocked the afternoon sun and promised rain. Fortunately, the inclement weather detoured visitors away from the beach, which he hoped would allow him time to properly dispose of the body. The fact that it wasn't raining and his jacket was dry made it not just bearable to be outside on a dreary February afternoon. It made it quite comfortable. Mitch rarely got cold, and he counted that as a blessing, especially since he had been hiding out along the beach for what seemed like an eternity, trying to figure out how to get rid of the body. He loathed double-crossers, ignoring the fact that Peter Morris would probably have good cause to accuse him of that infraction. However, Mitch really didn't care what Peter Morris thought of him. Morris deserved whatever he got. Standing up, he dusted off his slacks and made his way down the rocky mound. The body was not far away, tucked safely under some shrubbery. His first thought was to drag it to the ocean and let the sea take care of things, but he was afraid it would simply wash up on shore in a few days. When he reached the body, he stared at the bullet hole in the man's gut. "That must have hurt," he murmured, and then he looked at the man's eyes, which gazed vacantly up to the gray sky. Staring down at the man in fascination, Mitch tilted his head first to the right and then the left, as if a slight change in angle would make some significant difference in what he was seeing.
"How did you get yourself in this mess?" Mitch asked the corpse.
He then laughed and said,
"Oh, I remember. You were being greedy."
Mitch leaned down to the body, preparing to grab the man by his ankles, when he paused.
"Maybe if I fill your pocket with rocks, you think that might keep you in the water?"
The corpse remained silent. Mitch stood up and looked around, wondering where he might find rocks small enough to stuff into the man's pockets and down his pants. Although he wasn't sure that would weight the body down sufficiently to keep it in the ocean. It was then he heard it. Voices. Mitch was no longer alone on the beach. Without a second thought, he raced for cover, seeking refuge amongst the shrubbery. Peering out from his hiding place, he spied the people attached to the voices, two teenage girls. Smiling, Mitch thought, "I can easily take care of them. I already have one body to dispose of. What's two more?" He watched and waited as the two unsuspecting girls walked toward the corpse still hidden from their view. They chatted with each other, laughing and giggling, each oblivious to what lay just a few yards away. Engrossed in their teenage banter, neither girl was aware of Mitch, who hunkered down behind a bush they had just walked by. His plan was to wait until they stumbled upon the corpse before jumping from his hiding place and taking them both down. it would be easy. After all, he doubted either one weighed more than 90 pounds, and their surprise at finding a body along the beach would make it even more difficult for them to react to the situation in a manner that might actually save their lives. The little blonde saw it first. Her scream jolted even Mitch. The next moment, the other girl joined in and started screaming. Mitch slunk out from his hiding place. They had no idea he was right behind them as they looked down at the dead man, whose blank eyes stared into their terrified faces. Chris stood at his kitchen counter, unloading groceries. Just as he set a gallon of milk in the refrigerator, he heard pounding on his back sliding door. Pounding and shouting. Shutting the refrigerator, he walked to the door. Standing just outside were two teenage girls who looked as if someone wielding a chainsaw was on their heels. Quickly, he unlocked the door. The moment he did, the two girls practically flew inside, both shouting hysterically. It took him several minutes before he could calm them down enough to learn what had happened.
"He's dead," the petite blonde sobbed, "and he looked right at me."
"Who's dead?" Chris asked.
"We found a dead body on the beach. It's all bloated and gross, and his eyes are open,"
the other girl told him. "I want you both to sit down," Chris ordered. He immediately locked his door and picked up his cell phone. A moment later, he had the Frederickport Police Department on the line. When he was off the phone, he looked at the girls. "The police want you to wait with me until they get here. Did you see anyone near the body or on the beach?"
Both girls shook their heads. "Just the dead guy," the blonde said.
"Maybe you'd better call your parents and let them know what's going on and where you are. By the way, my name is Chris Johnson."
When Chris opened his door 10 minutes later, Brian Henderson was on his front porch.
"What's this about a dead body?" Brian asked.
Chris looked over Brian's shoulder. He didn't see any other officers.
"You came alone? Don't you need the coroner or something?" "I was in the neighborhood, so I told them I'd take the call. Let's see what we really have. You told the dispatcher you didn't see anything. Some girls did."
Chris opened his door wider. He stepped to one side, giving Brian room to enter.
"The girls are inside. They showed up at my back door screaming their heads off. Claimed they found a body on the beach."
Brian entered the house, first wiping his feet on the mat. He glanced around.
"So, this is your new place? I just moved in yesterday." "Nice. Right on the beach, too. Plus, not too far from Marlowe House."
Chris ignored Brian's comment and led him to the girls. Without waiting for the rest of the officers to show up, Brian had the girls lead them to the spot where they claimed to have found the dead man. Chris trailed along. When they got a few hundred yards from the spot, the girls stopped and pointed in the direction of the body. They refused to budge another foot. Chris saw the man hiding in the bushes. He was about to shout out to Brian when something stopped him. It was the way the man's hand moved through the foliage. Instead of saying anything, Chris ignored the man lurking nearby and walked with Brian to where the body lay. Hands on his hips, Brian looked down at the corpse and let out a sigh.
"If I'm not mistaken, that's our missing private detective. Sure looks like him." "Logan Mitchum?"
Brian pulled a clean handkerchief from his pocket and kneeled by the body. Covering his hand with a handkerchief, he gingerly removed the man's wallet.
"I'm going to kill you for bringing them here!"
Chris heard a male voice shout. He turned and watched as the man from the bushes jumped from his hiding place and lunged at the teenagers. Neither girl was aware of his presence and continued to whisper amongst themselves. When the girls ignored him, he turned his attention to Brian and Chris.
"What are you doing? Put that wallet back. It doesn't belong to you," the man wailed.
After opening the wallet and looking over the dead man's identification, Brian stood up.
"It's Mitchum, all right. Looks like he's been dead a while, but the coroner will be able to tell us more.
Can we go now?
One of the girls called out. She held a cell phone in her hand.
My mother just texted me. They just parked by Mr. Johnson's house.
I'd like to get both of your statements first.
Ryan looked at Chris. Would you wait here with a body? Make sure no one disturbs it. I want to walk the girls back, and the rest of my people should be pulling up around now.
Chris was about to answer when he paused a moment, watching in fascination as the man from the bushes stood nose to nose with Officer Henderson. The man scrunched his features into an ugly scowl and shouted,
"I said put that wallet back."
"Well?" Brian asked impatiently, waiting for Chris's response.
"Sure."
Chris waved his hand toward his house.
"I'll wait here. Feel free to use my kitchen table if you need some place to take the girl's statements."
"Thanks."
Brian turned from Chris.
"What is wrong with these people?" the man shouted.
Chris silently watched Brian and the girls head back to his house. When they were out of earshot, he looked at the ranting man and said,
"You're Logan Mitchum."
Mitch startled and swung around to face Chris.
"You can see me?" Mitch said.
"Yes."
"Why were they ignoring me? They acted like they couldn't even see me."
"Because they can't," Chris explained.
"Don't be ridiculous," Mitch snapped.
Impatiently, he combed his fingers through his shortly cropped hair. Chris wandered over to the body and looked down.
"Do you know who that is?"
Angrily walking to Chris, Mitch looked down at the body.
"I just know it's his fault I'm in this mess."
"So who is he?" Chris asked again.
A flicker of confusion crossed Mitch's face.
"I'm not really sure."
"Doesn't his face look a little familiar?"
Mitch shook his head.
"Why did you kill Peter Morris?" Chris asked.
Mitch's face broke out into an evil smile. His eyes narrowed and he looked over at Chris.
"So you know about that?"
"Sure."
"I could kill you right now before that cop comes back."
"I'm not the only one who knows," Chris told him. "All the cops know you slit Morris's throat. You left your fingerprint on Marlowe House's front gate."
"Big deal. I could have left my fingerprint there any time."
"Oh, did I mention it was a bloody fingerprint?"
"Morris's blood." "Doesn't prove anything. Everyone wanted him dead. If anyone knows that, I do."
"I wouldn't worry too much about being arrested for Morris's murder." Mitch eyed Chris suspiciously.
"Why do you say that?"
Chris nodded down to the corpse.
"Because that's you."
Thunderstruck, Mitch stared down at his corpse.
"Why don't you tell me who killed you?"
Mitch vanished.
"What do you mean you left Glendon with the body?" Joe hissed under his breath.
He stood with Brian in the front entry of Chris's beach house while another officer took statements from the teenage girls.
"Johnson, not Glendon," the chief reminded him.
He had just walked up behind Joe and caught his comment.
"What's the problem?" Brian asked. "I didn't want to leave the body unattended, and I needed to get a statement from the girls. They told me their folks were here to pick them up, and I was afraid they'd just take off and not wait. Both of them are pretty shaken."
"Are you implying Chris had something to do with Mitchum's murder?" the chief asked.
"We know Mitchum probably killed Morris, and we know Morris was blackmailing Johnson. Maybe Johnson hired Mitchum to do the job and then decided to get the hitman out of the way so it wouldn't come back to him."
"What, and leave the body a short distance from his new beach house?" the chief asked.
"Maybe he was getting ready to dump it in the ocean when the girls showed up."
"Stop trying so hard to pin this on Johnson," Brian snapped. "It's not like you, Joe."
"I'm just saying."
"I hear what you're saying," Brian cut him off, "and I don't like it. Plus, it makes no sense. You haven't seen the body yet. It's been dead for a couple days. If he were going to dump it in the ocean, he would have done it already. And according to the girls, he was nowhere around the body when they found it.
They went running to the first house they could find, and that happened to be Chris's. And by the looks of things in the kitchen, he had just come back from the grocery store. Didn't even have time to put all the groceries away when the girls showed up. What killer takes time to buy groceries before disposing of a body that's lying out in the open not far from his back door?
36.
This is a surprise, Danielle said, after she opened the front door and found Chris and McDonald standing on the porch together.
The chief said I could tag along, Chris explained.
Sounds interesting.
Danielle opened the door wider and showed them in. Together they went into the parlor.
Where are your guests?
The chief asked as he took a seat on one of the chairs facing the sofa.
Arlene and David left about 20 minutes ago. She said you told them they could.
I know where I can find them. McDonald removed his baseball cap and tossed it on the empty chair next to him.
Lily went to a show with Kelly, and I guess they ran into Heather at lunch, so she joined them.
Danielle sat down on the sofa.
Heather hanging out with Lily? What, did hell freeze over? Chris asked.
Danielle flashed Chris a smile and then looked at the chief.
So, what's up?
We found Logan Mitchum. Or rather, Chris found him.
Chris found the killer?
Walt asked as he appeared in the room, a lit cigar in his hand.
I didn't find him. The girls did, Chris corrected.
What girls? Danielle asked.
Where was he? McDonald wrinkled his nose and took a sniff. He looked around.
Is Walt in here with us?
Yes, he just popped in, Danielle explained.
Hello, Walt, the chief said with a grin. That's so weird, Chris mumbled.
He moved toward the empty place on the sofa next to Danielle, but Walt vanished from his spot by the desk and appeared in the next moment, sitting on the sofa where Chris was headed. Glaring at Walt, Chris moved instead to the desk and sat down.
Would someone please explain where you found him? Is he under arrest? Danielle asked.
He's dead, Chris told her.
Dead?
Danielle looked from Chris to the chief.
His body was found on the beach not far from Chris's place. Some teenage girls found it. By your place.
Walt looked over at Chris and smiled.
What have you been up to?
Funny, Walt.
Chris rested his elbow on the desk.
I'd just come back from the grocery store, and these two hysterical girls start pounding on my door. They both had cell phones, but at that point, they weren't in any position to use them.
According to the coroner, it looks like he was out there for a few days, the chief explained.
Those poor girls, Danielle muttered. Any idea how he died?
Someone shot him. I asked him who killed him, but he didn't say.
You saw him? Danielle asked.
His spirit was still hanging around. Not a particularly nice guy, by the way. I seriously think he would have killed one of us if he was capable of harnessing his energy.
Oh, that's lovely, Danielle said under her breath.
Considering the way he slit Peter Morris's throat, that doesn't surprise me, the chief said.
Are you certain he killed Morris? Danielle asked.
He didn't deny it when I told him I knew he killed Morris. He said I couldn't prove it and even threatened me. Mitchum was in that state where the spirit doesn't quite grasp the fact he's dead. He was looking right down at his dead body, staring himself in the eyes, but it just didn't seem to click with him that the body was his.
So he didn't tell you anything? Danielle asked.
Not really, aside from confirming what we already suspected. He killed Morris.
Now what? Danielle asked.
Brian and Joe are on their way to Portland to search his office and condo more thoroughly. The last time Brian went, the search warrant was limited. But now that Mitchum's dead, he's our new victim, and we won't have the same limitations. Hopefully, they'll find something.
I know Kelly didn't want to go home with Mitchum still at large.
I suppose she can go back to Portland now, Danielle said.
McDonald stood.
I just thought I'd stop by and let you know what's going on.
But we still have a killer on the loose. Danielle stood up.
Two murders in 1 week. Not sure about my new neighborhood.
Chris was only half-teasing. He followed Danielle and the chief out of the parlor while Walt remained behind, silently smoking his cigar.
Chief, what about Earthbound Spirits offices? Danielle asked when they got to the front door.
What about them?
Have you searched them yet? Or Peter Morris's home?
Maybe you'll find something there. You just said now that with Mitchum dead, you can go back and, I assume, do a more thorough search because he's now a victim.
With his hand on the doorknob, McDonald looked back at Danielle.
Searching Mitchum's home and office is not the same. Mitchum rented the condo in his own name. He wasn't married, lived alone, and he doesn't share his office with anyone. But with Peter Morris, Earthbound Spirits owns the offices, and even the house Peter Morris lived in is owned by Earthbound Spirits.
Does this mean you can't search any properties owned by Earthbound Spirits? After all, the man was murdered.
Yes, he was, Danielle. But so far we haven't been able to convince a judge to give us a warrant. Earthbound Spirits' attorney is arguing our purpose for wanting a search warrant has nothing to do with finding Morris's killer, but about going on a witch hunt to find something to tarnish the image of the organization Peter Morris founded.
Does this mean you aren't going to be able to get one?
No, it just means it's taking us longer than we'd like.
The chief looked at Chris.
You want to ride back to your place?
No, I can walk.
Chris glanced at Danielle.
I thought I'd stay and talk to Danielle a few minutes.
After the chief had gone, Chris stood alone with Danielle by the front door.
I was wondering, how's everything been going with you and Lucas? Is his spirit still lingering?
Danielle looked around the entry hall.
Yeah, I think so.
You think so?
It's been pretty crazy around here. Having a murder in the house tends to do that.
Chris smiled.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Lucas only seems to come around when I'm alone, which hasn't been happening much.
Is he still here?
Walt asked when he appeared the next moment.
It was nice seeing you too, Walt.
Walt smiled and then grew serious.
Chris, do you have any idea who might have killed that Palooka Mitchum?
Chris shrugged.
I have no idea. I wish he'd said more when I saw him.
Do you think he moved on? Danielle asked.
Either that or moved on with his body. I just don't like the idea of a killer moving through our neighborhood, Walt said.
Chris couldn't resist saying,
What do you care? You're dead.
Walt narrowed his eyes.
I was talking about Danielle and Lily. What about me? Chris teased. Don't you worry about me? I suppose I do, but only because I'm afraid if someone kills you, you might decide to move back into Marlowe House.
Chris reached for the door.
I know when I'm not wanted.
Danielle smiled. You don't have to leave.
I really have to get back to my house. I went to the store today and never finished putting my groceries away.
Okay, I'll let you know if I hear anything, Danielle promised. Chris gave her a nod, and as he went to pull open the door, Walt called his name. Turning to face the ghost of Marlowe House, he heard Walt say,
Be careful.
Danielle sat in the library with Max curled up on her lap. She absently stroked the cat's black fur as she listened to his loud purr and watched the fire flicker in the hearth. Walt had taken a book from the library and had retreated to the attic. Reading in the library wasn't practical with guests in the house. Books seemingly floating in midair might not be good for business. She contemplated going into the kitchen and making herself something to eat when she heard the front door open and the sound of paws clomping over the wood floor, heading in her direction. In the next moment, Sadie raced into the living room, her eye on Danielle's lap. Max heard the dog coming and immediately jumped up, greeting the golden retriever with a hiss. But Sadie was too much for the feline, and she easily dislodged the cat from his perch, taking his place. Danielle let out a grunt and found herself laughing as Sadie bathed her face in dog kisses. Disgusted, Max sauntered over to the fireplace and curled up on the throw rug. "Sorry about that," Lily said when she entered the room. "I swear, sometimes Sadie thinks she's a lapdog." Danielle patted the large canine, trying to get her to calm down. Sadie awkwardly circled Danielle's lap, her tail happily thumping against Danielle's chest as she attempted to make herself comfortable. With another grunt, Danielle gently shoved Sadie down while still giving her reassuring pats. Resigned to a spot on the floor, Sadie curled up by Danielle's feet. "So, Ian's driving to Portland with Kelly?" Danielle had recently talked to Lily on the phone, updating her on the missing private detective. "Yeah, Kelly wants to go home and get some of her things. While she feels better knowing Mitchum isn't a threat, we have no idea who killed him. In some ways, I think she's more afraid. At least before, when she thought Mitchum was the lone killer, she knew who to look out for." "I suppose I can understand that. If whoever killed Mitchum happened to be at Marlowe House at the time of Morris's murder and knows Kelly looked in the window, who knows what he or she might imagine Kelly witnessed? That's assuming they happened to find out Kelly was over here that night. And since Carla is the one who saw her, I imagine half the town already knows. At least Carla didn't know who she saw exactly. Anyway, Ian's going to drive down with Kelly so she can pick up some of her stuff, and they'll come back in the morning. Since she works online, she can do that anywhere. But just between you and me, it seems a little nuts because both murders happened near Ian's house. So, if it was me, I'd probably feel just as safe in Portland. But don't tell anyone I said that." "I won't." "Why didn't you go with them?" "I've a dentist appointment in the morning, remember? They'll be back tomorrow night." Lily smiled and then looked to the doorway with a questioning frown. "I didn't see Heather's car out front. Do you know where she is?" "Heather called after I talked to you on the phone. She went to Vancouver to stay with friends." "When I left her after the show, she didn't say anything about going to Vancouver." "Speaking of the show," Danielle smiled mischievously, "did you see 50 Shades of Grey? I know it just started playing at the theater." Lily laughed. No. The idea of sitting through a movie like that with my boyfriend's little sister, not to mention Heather. No thanks. That ain't happening." Danielle laughed and then redirected the conversation. "I've a hunch Heather decided to take off again when she learned there was another murder in the neighborhood. I'd called her right after I talked to you about them finding Mitchum's body, and then she called back 15 minutes later, saying not to expect her tonight." "Didn't she even stop by to take a shower or change her clothes?" Lily asked. "This afternoon she looked like she'd slept in her clothes." "No. But I figure she probably stopped by her house and grabbed what she needs. I don't think she brought all of her clothes with her when she moved in here. According to her, they've stored most of her things, what she didn't have to get rid of, in the garage. There wasn't any mold in there." Lily glanced up to the ceiling. "Where's Walt, by the way?" "Reading in the attic. Bella's up there with him. But I might as well tell him to read down here since everyone's going to be gone." "Oh, there is also Lucas." Lily glanced around the room. "Lucas is still here?" "I think so. He briefly showed himself this morning and then vanished.
I still can't believe he's here. And why is he here? To be honest, I can't wrap my head around it. And frankly, I would rather not deal with it. I had put all that behind me. I wish he'd just move on. Well, have you talked to him? I mean, really talked to him. Asked him why he's here? From what I understand, he's been in some sort of ghost limbo since he died, hanging out in a building near the site of the accident. He just recently came to terms with the fact he's no longer alive. But instead of moving on, which is the natural progression, he decided to find me. There must be a reason. Yeah, well, that's sort of what Walt and Chris says, too. They both tell me I need to resolve whatever issues Lucas and I have so both he and I can move on. Sounds like a good idea to me. I thought I had moved on. Anyway, he never sticks around long enough for us to have a real discussion. Lily stood up. One thing about living in Marlowe House, it's never ordinary. I'm going to go up and take a shower. Danielle glanced down at the sleeping golden retriever. I assume Sadie is staying with us? If that's okay. Sadie is always welcome. I'm sure Walt would love to see her. Opening his eyes, Max lifted his head and looked over at the sleeping dog. As soon as Max's gaze set on Sadie, the dog's tail began to thump, but her eyes remained closed while her chin rested soundly on her front paws. 37. The rain clouds had vacated the Portland sky. It promised to be a sunny Monday morning. Wearing fuzzy pink slippers and casually dressed in blue sweatpants and sweatshirt, Kelly wasn't going far, just to her car to grab something she had forgotten to bring in the night before. When she reached the bottom of the stairs, she noticed the door to Mitch's place was ajar, and she could hear voices coming from inside. Her first impulse was to flee up the stairs to her own condo, where Ian was, but when she looked over to the parking lot, she saw the Frederickport police car. Curious, she walked over to Mitch's open doorway and peeked inside. Sitting on Mitch's sofa were Brian Henderson and Joe Morelli, sorting through several file boxes.
Some businesses keep a second set of books. Mitchum obviously kept a second set of client files, Kelly heard Brian say.
Not wanting to be seen, she stepped out of the doorway's view, listening.
Talk about someone playing both sides, Joe said. Looks like that tip the chief got about Mitchum working for Morris was spot on. Over the last few years, Morris paid Mitchum a small fortune to investigate potential members and their families. If Mitchum wasn't so meticulous in his record-keeping, there wouldn't be a paper trail. Looks like he was always paid in cash, Brian noted.
Nervously, Kelly nibbled on her lower lip, her ear close to the partially open doorway.
Considering what he was being paid between Morris and the clients who hired him to spy on Morris, I wonder what he did with his money, Joe said. By his credit card records, all those trips to Vegas and the Indian casinos, and the pile of lottery tickets in his trash can, I'd say Mr. Mitchum had a gambling problem. Well, look here, Kelly heard Joe say.
She was tempted to peek into the doorway, but kept herself out of sight.
Apparently, Kelly Bardley was one of Mitchum's assignments. According to the notes in this file, Morris got wind of the exposé Ian was working on, and Morris paid him to move into her complex to spy on her.
Keeping perfectly still, Kelly found herself holding her breath and closing her eyes, not wanting to be discovered.
Bingo, Brian said. Apparently, someone did hire Mitchum to kill Morris. And you'll never guess who.
Kelly opened her eyes and listened.
Justice Now. Talk about working both sides.
While he may have retired his cowboy boots for the rainy season, Will Wayne still clung to his cowboy hat. The Western persona he had created those many years ago had become a part of who he was.
As a gentleman does, he had removed his hat the moment he entered the front lobby of the Frederickport Police Department. He carried his cattleman hat in one hand and his cane in the other, using it to help steady his way. The woman from the front desk led him to the chief's office after informing her boss of his arrival. She left him alone in the office with the chief, who sat behind the desk.
"Please, sit down," McDonald said, after standing up and greeting Will.
When both men were seated, Will reached into his jacket's inside pocket and removed an envelope.
"I received this in the mail."
Leaning forward, he placed the opened envelope on the desktop and pushed it toward McDonald.
"It came on Saturday, but I didn't see it until yesterday."
McDonald leaned forward and picked up the envelope, looking at it as he flipped it from side to side.
"What is it?"
Will nodded toward the envelope in McDonald's hand.
"Just read it."
With a curious frown, McDonald removed the letter before tossing its envelope to the desk. Leaning back, he unfolded the sheet of paper and began to read. Will thought the room unbearably quiet. Considering the amount of time McDonald spent reading the letter, Will was certain the police chief had read and reread it numerous times. Finally, McDonald refolded the sheet of paper and gently placed it atop the envelope on his desk. He looked at Will.
"Do you know who sent this to you?"
Will shook his head.
"I keep thinking it had to have been Logan Mitchum, because he's the only one I ever discussed killing Morris with, and he brought up the conversation. I didn't. But this morning, I heard the news about the police finding Logan Mitchum's body, and that it had been on the beach for a few days, so it couldn't have been him." "Well, it could have been sent by Mitchum. We think he was killed sometime Friday after Morris was murdered. Whoever mailed this to you could have mailed it on Friday if it arrived on Saturday." "I didn't hire a hit on Peter Morris. I need you to know that." "Why are you bringing me this?" I want to be up front with the police. Complete disclosure. At this point, I don't know if Isabella died of natural causes or not, but even if I thought Morris had her killed, I would never do something like hire a hitman. What good would that do? Earthbound spirits would still be here, living on after Morris was gone, taking advantage of other vulnerable people. Remove Morris, and someone else just replaces him."
McDonald picked up the letter.
"I appreciate you bringing this to me. I'd like to keep it."
"Certainly." The moment Danielle walked into the police chief's office, McDonald looked up and set his cell phone on his desk.
"I was just getting ready to call you," he told her. "What did you do, sneak past the front girl?"
"I'm curious. If Joe was sitting at the front desk, would you ask me if I slipped by the front boy?" McDonald chuckled.
"Point taken."
"Anyway, your security is really slipping around here." Danielle sat down.
"That's what Lily told me. Speaking of Lily, have you talked to her?"
"Talked to her? Just this morning at breakfast. Why?"
"Have you spoken to her within the last 30 minutes? He asked.
"No, she's at the dentist having a root canal."
"Kelly is missing," he announced.
Danielle frowned. "What do you mean, Kelly is missing?"
"Brian and Joe spent last night and most of this morning going through Logan Mitchum's office and home. They came across some information that they needed to question Kelly about. But when they went to her apartment, she wasn't there. According to Ian, when he got out of the shower this morning, she was gone. But she didn't take her purse or cell phone, just her car keys."
"Gone?" Danielle stood up abruptly. "Has she been kidnapped? Did Mitchum's killer grab her?"
"According to one of the neighbors Brian talked to, they saw Kelly getting into her car and driving off about the same time Ian says he was in the shower."
Danielle sat back down. "But why would she just leave without her purse or phone, without telling her brother where she was going?"
I have no idea, and neither does Ian. I also had a visit from Will Wayne this morning.
MacDonald picked up Will's letter and tossed it across the desk to Danielle.
He brought me this. Says it came in the mail over the weekend. Insists he never hired a hitman.
Danielle quietly picked up the letter and began to read. When she was done, she looked across the desk at MacDonald and frowned.
When I interviewed Will after Morris's murder, he told me Mitchum offered to hook him up with a hitman, but Will insists he told him he wasn't interested. And then he gets this blackmail letter a few days after Morris's death.
Danielle didn't respond immediately. After considering all the recent events, she said, "None of this makes sense. Have Brian and Joe found anything useful in Portland?"
"They found information that confirms what Adam told us. Mitchum had been working for Morris. He was hired to investigate potential members. I guess he had quite an extensive file on both you and Chris. According to Mitchum's notes, Morris had written you off and refocused his attention on Chris. He also got wind of Ian and Kelly's investigation. Apparently, he moved to that condo specifically to be near Kelly and spy on her."
"Kelly? Where is Kelly?" Danielle murmured.
"Hopefully she just ran to the grocery store or something, and there's a simple explanation."
"Are they any closer to figuring out who killed Mitchum? Do you think this person was working with Mitchum to kill Morris, or was Mitchum killed in retaliation for killing Morris?"
MacDonald leaned forward, resting his elbows on the desktop. "This is what they've pieced together so far. It looks like Mitchum was working exclusively for Morris, getting paid well for investigating possible donors. But then Earthbound Spirits started having some money issues."
"Money issues?"
"Things started falling apart right after Christmas, after Cleve killed himself. Not sure what happened exactly, but Earthbound Spirits' funds weren't where they were supposed to be."
"Are you saying there was missing money? Someone was embezzling?"
"That and some poor investments. Even before Cleve's death, wealthy members started backing away from the group. Donations stopped."
"Maybe they realized it was a scam?"
"Perhaps. Funds were tight for Morris. He couldn't really afford Mitchum anymore, but he couldn't afford not to use him. So they made a deal. Mitchum would be compensated for whatever donations he helped facilitate. He would no longer be paid up front, but by a percentage of the donation after it came in."
"So basically, he was working on commission."
"Exactly. But it appears that after the first of the year, things started to change. Up until that point, Mitchum had been hiring himself out to people who had a grievance with Earthbound Spirits. He sold himself as someone who wanted to take the cult down. But the truth was, he was feeding false information to his clients."
"Up until that point. So something changed?"
"Not only did he start giving his clients the real dirt on Earthbound Spirits and Morris, he fed them false negative information, like with Will Wayne. The notes Joe and Brian found in Wayne's file verify what I thought all along. Morris had nothing to do with Isabella's death."
"So Mitchum lied to Will?"
"It seems as if Mitchum realized the tide had changed for his boss. The gravy train was about to come to an end. According to his notes, he was going to do something that would be his big payday, and he could retire."
"What was that?" Danielle asked.
"That's the problem. I'm not really sure."
"If it was to murder Morris and then blackmail Will for it, the money demand in the letter isn't really something he could retire on," Danielle noted.
"Not unless the blackmailer considers that the first installment."
"Not unless he has something to prove Will hired the hitman. It seems like wasted energy. I would think if he had anything, Will wouldn't have brought you the letter."
"True. Unless Wayne is the one who killed Mitchum. Since finding Morris's body, Mitchum's house and office have been under surveillance.
There was no way for the killer to get in and destroy any evidence.
Bringing me this letter might be Wayne's way of making himself look innocent if we happen to find something incriminating.
Danielle stood up. I just don't see Will hiring a hitman and then killing him.
When I spoke to Wayne the first time about Mitchum, it was after Morris was killed. Consider this. Mitchum does the hit for Wayne and then immediately goes to Wayne and blackmails him. Instead of paying Mitchum, Wayne kills him. Wayne doesn't know Mitchum carelessly left behind a bloody fingerprint. When I show up after the murder and start asking questions about Mitchum, Wayne tosses out the story about Mitchum offering to set him up with a hitman. His way of throwing us off, just like with this letter.
If Mitchum blackmailed him in person and Wayne killed him, what about the blackmail letter? Why send a letter?
Maybe Mitchum didn't send the letter. Maybe Wayne wrote it himself, the chief suggested.
Danielle began pacing back and forth in front of the desk.
No, that doesn't make sense.
I admit it has some holes, McDonald conceded.
Like Swiss cheese. Danielle took a deep breath and exhaled. This is freaking driving me nuts. There is only one thing to do.
What's that?
I need to talk to Logan Mitchum.
38. The first thing Danielle noticed was the distinct odor, a combination of chemicals and death. It made her nose twitch. The smell got stronger as she made her way down the hallway.
McDonald assured her there was no one at the morgue. They had all gone out for lunch.
However, she could hear voices just beyond the doorway. Someone was here, and they were shouting or simply arguing loudly. Either way, she knew they were just inside the room she was about to enter. Stealing her courage, she approached the door, reached out, and gripped its handle. She would normally take a deep breath to calm herself, but that was not an option. She had no desire to drink in more of the noxious fumes than was absolutely necessary. The moment she opened the door, her fears were confirmed. While she knew the bodies of both Peter Morris and Logan Mitchum were still at the morgue, she had hoped the only spirit still lingering would be Mitchum's. He was the only one she needed to talk to. For whatever reason, they both remained, and judging by the angry verbal exchange, they were unhappy with each other. She wondered if that was why they were both still here. Mitchum had followed his body to the morgue before Morris had time to move on, and seeing each other, the two had clashed, keeping them both grounded to this plane while they riled at each other. Or perhaps neither one cared for an extremely hot climate, which Danielle suspected would be their next stop after this one. The two spirits stopped shouting at each other the moment Danielle walked into the room. She had made the decision before opening the door to pretend not to see them. Since their death, both had been surrounded by people who could not see them, such as police officers and members of the coroner's office, so she didn't imagine they would find her inability to see them unusual.
"What's she doing here?" Morris asked.
Ignoring both spirits, Danielle walked over to a chair and sat down. She took out her cell phone and pretended to be surfing.
"Looks like she's waiting for someone," Mitchum said.
Morris quickly lost interest in Danielle and turned his attention back to Mitchum. The two men began shouting at each other again. If she had hoped to learn anything from their exchange, she was sorely disappointed. While they confirmed what she already suspected, the private detective had murdered Peter Morris. She learned nothing new. After 10 minutes, Danielle had had enough. If the smell didn't make her throw up, the shouting was sure to make her head explode. Annoyed, she stood up, shoved her cell phone into the back pocket of her jeans, and faced the men.
"Shut up!" she shouted at the top of her lungs. "You two are driving me freaking nuts! Just shut up!"
Both spirits froze, their screaming silenced. Slowly, they turned to face her. Danielle smiled smugly and sat back down, primly crossing her legs. "Perhaps we can now have a civil conversation?"
"You can hear us?" Mitchum asked. "Like Landon. He heard me."
"Ah, you recognized Chris, did you?" Danielle smiled. "Yes, he's like me. We can see spirits."
"Why can't anyone else see us?" Morris asked.
Maybe because you're dead?"
"You don't have to be so snotty," Mitchum grumbled.
Danielle laughed. "Seriously?" She pointed to Morris. "This one talks people into killing themselves for money, and you kill people for money. So, how's it feel, guys, being dead? All cracked up to what you thought it would be?"
"Why are you here?" Morris asked.
"I want to know who killed your friend here. We already know who killed you."
"He's not my friend," Morris snapped.
He glared at Mitchum and asked Danielle,
"And how do you know who killed me?"
"Your PI here left his fingerprint behind, on my fence. A bloody fingerprint. Your blood."
"I'm glad he's dead. I just don't want him here," Morris shouted.
"So, who killed him?"
"I know why he died," Morris laughed. "Oh, shut up," Mitchum snapped.
"Go on," Danielle said, now crossing her arms across her chest as she watched the two agitated spirits pace the room.
"It was greed," Morris shouted.
Mitchum laughed.
"Greed? You're accusing me of being greedy? You, who couldn't wait for someone to die of natural causes to get a hold of their money?"
"How did greed get Mr. Mitchum here killed?" Danielle asked.
"He had this brilliant scheme," Morris said sarcastically. "He wanted to convince all those people who had once hired him to investigate me to hire a hitman and take me out. Of course, they wouldn't know he was the hitman."
"Wait a minute," Danielle said. "From what I understand, Mr. Mitchum here, while on your payroll, initially told most of those folks he couldn't find anything on Earthbound spirits."
"So?" Mitchum asked. "I told them I couldn't find anything that would stick in a court of law, which just made them more frustrated. It should have made them more willing to seek justice in another way."
"Are you saying more than one person hired you to kill Morris?"
Morris laughed. "Logan's plan didn't go quite like he thought it would, which rather pissed him off, although he did get one person to bite." "So, I could have still made them pay," Mitchum insisted.
"And how was that?" Danielle asked.
"With Peter murdered and what I had on my clients, I'm sure I could have gotten money from most of them."
"Are you saying you intended to frame them for Morris's murder?"
"Sure. I had enough evidence to convince the police to arrest more than one of my clients. What they would end up paying for legal fees would be far more expensive than what I was asking."
"So who killed you?" Danielle asked. Mitchum glared at Morris.
"The same client who paid me to kill Peter."
Nervously nibbling her lower lip, Kelly stood on the front porch of the Bradford estate. She glanced down at her slipper-clad feet. "I didn't think this out very well," she muttered to herself. Awkwardly, she ran the palms of her hands over her sweatshirt, as if that would, in some way, make her more presentable. Before getting out of her car, she had tried to straighten her hair, but she didn't have a brush or comb with her. Had she taken time to grab her purse before impulsively driving off, she wouldn't just have a comb, but some makeup as well.
Resisting the temptation to simply turn around, head back to her car, and go home, Kelly rang the doorbell. A few minutes later, Bailey Bradford opened the front door. Like Kelly, she hadn't dressed for the day, but Bailey's silk lounging suit looked far more glamorous. She wore her long blonde hair pulled up into a feminine twist.